Welcome to the Complexity Premier Podcast. My name is Chris Joy. I'm a portfolio manager at Coolabah Capital Investments, and I'm joined by Ying Yi and Cheng, a portfolio management director. Hey, Ying, how are you going?
Yeah, I'm great, thanks. So, Chris, you wrote in the AFR on Friday that the RBA is caught in a political spin. What do you mean by that?
Yes, well, Ying, is one of the great myths in Australia's battle against what is the worst inflation crisis since the 1980s is that our central bank can keep rates miles below its global peers because monetary policy is more potent here. The narrative goes that because of Australia's preponderance of variable rate home loans compared with countries like the US, where most borrowers have fixed rate debt, a 100 basis point increase in rates here has far greater influence on inflation outcomes. The issue is that the RBA's own research suggests this is incorrect. Notwithstanding Governor Michelle Bullock's claim last week that the transmission mechanism is in fact more effective here. In response to a question asked by a journo as to why the RBA's 4.35% cash rate is so far below New Zealand's 5.5% rate, and whether the RBA has gone hard enough or been too timid, Bullock offered a fairly surprising answer. Rather than quoting the RBA's own detailed research on the topic, she stated that, quote, "You would know that there was some recent work done by the IMF and it looked at how interest rates impact various countries. It's very clear that it impacts Australia very quickly because of our relatively high share of variable rate mortgages." So that's what she said. While strictly speaking, Bullock was right to say that the cash flow channel of policy is felt more quickly by our households. Her key message was that Australia is different and doesn't really need to lift rates as far as New Zealand or other countries like America, where the cash rate's 5.25% to 5.5%, Britain, where it's 5.25%, and Canada, where it's 5%. Is that the IMF research that Bullock cited did not actually look at how changes in interest rates affect inflation overall. It only focused on how monetary policy modulates activity via the housing market. And naturally, when examining only this sector, Australia did look like it was more sensitive to rates, again, only via the housing market. If, on the other hand, Yinger's Bullock had chosen to quote the RBA's detailed analysis on the topic, which was published in February 2023, she would have given a very different response, and that would have been, quote, "The available evidence suggests that the effect of Australian monetary policy on activity and inflation is similar to that in other comparable advanced economies." The RBA referenced the fact that global academic research had found that a tightening of Australian monetary policy has a similar effect on output and inflation as in other countries, and it concluded, quote, "Estimates from the major central banks' macroeconomic models are also broadly similar to those of the RBA's Martin and Dynamic Stochastic General Equilibrium, or DSGE, models."
And Chris, empirically, we know that over the last 30 years, the RBA has typically kept its target cash rate around 150 basis points higher than the US Fed's benchmark. The anomaly that can't be explained is why the RBA's cash rate is now about 100 basis points below the Fed's target. There is also the inconvenient truth that the RBA's Martin model of the economy recommends a circa 5% cash rate right now, as Coolabah's research and that of Jonathan Kearns, Challenger's chief economist, has highlighted. And Kearns, as we have previously referenced, was until recently the RBA's head of economic analysis. And Chris, there is one further fly in the ointment. In contrast to the prior three RBA tightening processes, the pass-through to mortgage rates has been much lower this time around as a function of more intense competition between lenders.
Yeah, that's right, Ying, as in prior periods when the RBA lifted rates, banks would normally jack up their own variable mortgage rates by the same margin, and actually then some. For example, in the 99 to 2000 hiking cycle, banks passed on 101% of the RBA's increases to borrowers. In the 2002 to 2008 episode, the pass-through was, on our numbers, 109% of the RBA's hikes. And in the 2009 to 2010 cycle, banks passed through a chunky 115%, which they blamed on their funding costs. And yet, desperate to avoid losing market share, the experience since the RBA began hiking in May 2022 has been very different. Coolabah's macro team estimates that the pass-through to new variable rate home loan borrowers has only been 91%, while the pass-through to the much more important existing variable rate home loans has only been 82%. And because of the prevalence of a record share of fixed rate as opposed to floating rate mortgages taken out during the pandemic, the pass-through across all borrowers has been just 78%, which is the lowest since the early 1990s. So Yinger's Aussie households have only therefore worn about 333 basis points of the total 425 basis points of rate rises the RBA originally planned to impose. Given it would have been impossible for the RBA to predict this extremely poor pass-through, monetary policy is significantly more stimulatory than it actually intended. Coolabah's chief macro strategist, Kieran Davies, has noted here, Yingas, that the heightened importance of the household cash flow channel for monetary policy in Australia has led many analysts to incorrectly believe that higher interest rates are more effective here. However, this doesn't appear to be the case insofar as the RBA and other central bank modelled estimates of the peak effect of rates on inflation is similar across Australia, the euro area, and the US.
Chris, the RBA is therefore actively choosing to tolerate hotter inflation and only very slowly return to the 2.5% midpoint of its target band by late 2026. The risk, as we've spoken about, is that it continues to underestimate the strength of the core inflation pulse, as it has done recently. One explanation for this lack of concern is that the RBA wants to preserve job gains given its dual mandate to provide for both price stability and full employment. For the past 30 years, the RBA has argued that focusing on price stability enabled it to support full employment given the inherent trade-offs between the objectives, noting that a reduction in inflation normally requires higher unemployment. The RBA might also be keen to avoid upsetting politicians at a time when it is in the middle of negotiations with the government regarding the establishment of its new monetary policy committee. These negotiations are further complicated by the looming federal election.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with that, and we've spoken about it before, and these political dynamics probably also help explain the RBA's very unusual cheerleading of the federal budget before its release. In her press conference after the board meeting, RBA Governor Michelle Bullock claimed that, quote, "The point I would make is that the federal treasurer says publicly, and he says to me in private, that he does have inflation in his mind while he is thinking about the budget. I think the budgets are very difficult. They're big balancing acts for governments. They've got lots of things on their plate, and I think they are all conscious that they want to help us beat inflation. So they don't want to try to add to inflationary pressures. The signs, at least by what has been said to me, is that inflation is front of mind." And yet, since the budget's release, all sensible economists agree that it will very clearly add to inflationary pressures rather than attenuate them.
And Chris, on that particular point, I wanted to reference Barrenjoey's chief rate strategist, Andrew Lilly, who highlighted that the $300 power subsidy lowers inflation this year, but increases it by the same margin next year when it expires. And Lilly said that, quote, "The total announced electricity subsidies reduced measured headline inflation by about 70 basis points in calendar year 2024, then increased measured headline inflation by 70 basis points in 2025. Lilly continued, and I quote, "Contrary to media reports, this won't change the RBA's reaction function. It just makes this a period in which headline inflation is affected by quirks. Moreover, these subsidies just make inflation stickier, both directly in measurement, lifting inflation in 2025, and indirectly by relaxing budget constraints."
Ying is an HSBC's chief economist, Paul Bloxham, who spent a long time working at the RBA, added, "We expect the boost to household disposable incomes from these subsidies and the substantial boost to disposable income from the personal income tax cuts will see increased consumer spending, which will support underlying inflation rather than lower it." And listeners should remember that the tax cuts that come into play from the 1st of July are worth another three additional RBA rate cuts, assuming they're fully spent. A final example of the sentiment coming from economists years was CBA's chief economist, Stephen Howe-Marrick, who stated, quote, "The risk is now more real that the first interest rate cut could be delayed and that the neutral cash rate is higher than we currently estimate due to the expansionary fiscal setting and the high level of investment in the economy." So central banks used to be ferociously independent of the political process. The worrying is now is this may no longer be the case. And we're seeing clearly the Fed kowtowing to political imperatives in the US. And I think somewhat perhaps understandably, the RBA is, and I say understandably in the context of the pretty profound negotiations it's embroiled with government and the parliament over the monetary policy setting process, and specifically the establishment of the new RBA Governance Board and the Monetary Policy Committee.
So, Chris, we covered off in detail on April performance last week. How is May travelling?
Yeah, Yingas, we've seen some solid returns in May to date. We've also observed a duration rally or an increase in the value of fixed rate bond prices as long-term interest rates have declined a little as a result of the US inflation print, the first cut of that, the CPI measure for April, coming out in line with expectations. So it's still very strong, but there was no significant an upside surprise, as we had seen in the four prior months. And here in Australia, we had a slightly softer jobs report with the unemployment rate bumping up to 4.1%. But as our chief macro strategist, Kieran Davies, explained in a note that we published on LiveWire last week, we think there might be some statistical noise that has interfered with that outcome. We also had a slightly softer than expected wage print in Australia. And so while wage growth has still been very brisk at 4.1% year on year, we didn't see an upside surprise that might have been otherwise feared by investors. Just as a reminder, you mentioned April yingers. In the 12 months of data that we have available to April, our long short credit fund has returned 12.2% after all retail fees. That's an A-plus rated into the average credit rating on its bonds, floating rate strategy, or a portfolio that targets yields that will rise and fall with the RBA's cash rate. And as at 30 April, it had a cash running yield of 7.3% gross and provides daily liquidity. Now, while the Long Short Credit Fund is a global credit portfolio, we actually have an Australian credit iteration of that strategy, similar but not identical. It's called the Floating Rate High Yield Fund. It's returned 11.8% after retail fees over the last 12 months and is currently providing a cash running yield of 8.1%. gross, and it also has an average credit rating on its bonds of A plus and provides for daily liquidity. For those wanting to get exposure to fixed rate bonds, we obviously run our active composite bond fund, which is an ETF called FIXD, and that has outperformed the fixed rate bond benchmark in Australia by 4.4 percentage points over the last 12 months. Please note the disclaimer at the end of this podcast that obviously past performance is no guide to future returns, and you should read the product PDSs to better understand the risks. We obviously encourage listeners to actively consult a financial advisor, and nothing on this podcast is personal financial advice, it's general information only. So, Yingers, I think that about does us for this week. Great to catch up and chat again and sort of provide a snapshot summary of what we've been talking about internally and what we're thinking about more globally. If you want to catch up with our real-time insights, I'm posting regularly to Twitter at CJOYE. Kieran Davies and myself also publish research at LiveWire. I write my AFR column, which is published online normally on Friday afternoons, and it's in the print version of the newspaper on Saturdays. And, of course, you can go to our website, callbycapital.com.
This podcast does not provide financial advice. It is not an invitation to invest in any financial product, and the information in it should not be relied on for any decisions. All views expressed represent the personal opinions of the speaker and do not represent the view of any other party. If this recording contains reference to any financial products, that reference does not constitute advice or a recommendation and should not be relied upon. Listeners in Australia are encouraged to visit the moneysmart.gov.au website to obtain information regarding financial advice and investments.